Thank you very much, Kevin. Ooh, 80 degrees here on October 9th. Yeah, celebrate that. Hope you get outside a little bit. Hope you spend some time with us. Let's Get Legal coming up, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm your host, John Hanson. I'll take you till 5 o'clock. We've got a packed show. Talking with Jeffrey Colwin. Man, he might as well be the co-host here. We've had a lot of employment law questions. You have, too. We've got some more based on some real crazy news stories this week. We'll talk to Jeffrey in just a little bit. We're going to be talking to Nora Devine from the Devine Law Group. So start thinking about any tax questions you may have. John Hagee from Walker Law going to stop on by as well. We're talking eviction moratorium and plenty more coming up on Let's Get Legal. Our question of the day, and if you know the answer, or if you even want to take a guess, call in 312-981-7200. Call right now. Here's the question. Four states, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine, are the only four states that ban what? Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, Maine are four states, the only four states that ban what? If you have any idea, 312-981-7200. Sometimes it's fine to just take a guess. Let's Get Legal next, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Thank you very much, Ernie. Hey, everyone. John Hanson on 720 WGN. Let's Get Legal. We got a great show, a packed show for you today, taking you up until 5 o'clock, examining a lot of what's happening in the world, in our state, and in our city from a legal lens with experts. I am not one of those experts here. I'm just here to ask the dumb questions that you may have, and feel free for you to join the conversation, too, 312-981-7200. Our question of the day, at least to start, until someone gets it right, four states, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine are the only four states that ban what? If you call in, I'll give you three guesses. If you get it right, I'll give you the prize. I'll represent you in the court of law at a future date. You will not want that. I have not passed the bar. I have not gone to law school, but I'll stand up there for you if you need it. 312-981-7200. A lot of people texted in their guesses. I'd love for you to call in instead. We had someone call in that didn't want to, or did they not want to say it on air? They were too frightened.
They were so excited. They said the answer, and then they hung up.
They said, what, sleep in the nude?
Sleeping in the nude.
No, I don't think that's banned anywhere. I imagine you can do that if you want. And no, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine have not banned sleeping in the nude. Aridian, any guesses?
Eating things in the grocery store?
Eating things in the grocery store. No, but that, like, have you ever done that? Do you ever wander and eat something? I see people eating grapes all the time. It drives me crazy.
Sometimes. I'm not going to admit a lot.
All right, that's fine. Getting some callers now already. I'll get those on the line. 312-981-7200 as we continue to figure out who of the four states, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine, they are the only four states that ban what. As we get some of those guesses ready, I just want to let you know what's coming up on the program here today. Jeffrey Colwin's going to join us. He's a employment law expert. And did you hear the crazy story of the NBA players who scammed their health insurance? These are people that, even if they're making the league minimum, these players making $1 million, and they scammed, or at least they're alleged to have scammed, their health insurance for the NBA. He's going to talk a little bit about how that happened, or allegedly happened, and what happens next, as well as Tesla facing a lawsuit for racial discrimination that ended up in the courts. And that's really rare for law, for employment matters to actually end up in the court of law. A lot of these things like to be, delegated through arbitrators, but that didn't happen in this Tesla case, and it's a huge jury verdict. What are the odds that this gentleman will get that verdict? We'll have to wait and see, or get that full amount. But we got some guessers on the line. Pat, you're on WGN. Hey, Pat. Pat, you're on the air. How are you doing today? Good, good. Sorry, I forgot to hit. I forgot to hit one button, Pat. Where are you calling from today?
Lake Geneva.
Gorgeous up there this time of year. Gorgeous day today. Wisconsin isn't one of these states. Nice. Neither is Illinois, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, Maine. The only four states that ban what?
I'm going to take a long shot and say vaping.
Vaping. Great guess. No. I'll give you one more. How about that, Pat?
One more.
Not vaping, but... If you don't got it, I'll go to someone else. That's okay, Pat.
Go to someone else, buddy.
I will. Thank you, Pat. Thanks for calling from Lake Geneva. Let's go to Barb. Barb, you're on WGN. How are you doing today, Barb?
Fine.
Where are you calling from?
Well, I'm on the road right now, but I'm from Petersburg, Illinois.
Petersburg, Illinois. Okay, so what do Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine have in common with what they banned?
Plastic bags.
Plastic bags is a great guess. No. In fact, that was going to be another question I had maybe later on in another week. Okay. I've got it right in front of me. 8 states banned the use of plastic bags. California, ooh, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, New York, Oregon, and Vermont. That's not the answer today, but thanks for guessing, Barb. We appreciate it.
Okay. All right.
Let's go to Frank. Frank, you're on WGN. What are those 4 states, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine? They have banned what?
Billboards.
Billboards is right. We got our answer here in the opening segment. Did you know that or did you Google that, Frank?
I had to search for it. I was going to say spam, but I'm a lover of spam.
Oh, wait, spam the meat or spam what comes in your email?
Oh, the meat.
Very good. Yes, it is billboards. Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine, they ban the use of billboards. I think Alaska and Hawaii makes sense to me. I was kind of surprised that 2 Northeast states were on the list, too. Certainly not here in Illinois, Frank, on our expressways.
No, not here at all.
Not here at all. All right, Frank from the South Side. Have you ever,
every block.
Yeah, if you ever need me to represent you in court, you call WGN, okay?
Okay, sir.
That's your prize. Very good. All right, we're going to talk with Attorney Jeffrey Colwin about employment law and a lot more. And I'll have another question of the day to refire up at the bottom of the hour. And we'll see if we can get the rest of the show without an answer for that one. But congrats to Frank on that prize. All coming up here on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Well, he's might as well be co-host of the show. Jeffrey Colwin, we call you when we got employment questions. Thanks for hopping on again today.
Well, thanks for having me, John. It's my good fortune that it's been such an interesting week in the legal news.
Boy, has it ever. And thanks again. And I didn't mention this at the top of the show. Big thanks to Matt Bubala for filling in for me last week as I got to go to a wedding. You and him had a great chat, I heard. And I want to dive into a couple different stories here. Let's start with Amazon. They've been accused of violating Colorado state law by failing to pay workers for time that was spent undergoing COVID-19 screenings before clocking in at work. And at first I thought, well, how much time really is it to use the temperature gun? But it was more than that. And a lot of workers say, hey, you know, this took 20 minutes, this took 30 minutes, sometimes an hour to get us all through in line. They should have to pay us for that. Do you see that that's, I mean, at least how we see it, that they should be paid for that time?
It's an interesting question, yes. I do think that they should be paid for that time. Whether the law requires them to be paid for that time is a more complicated question. It seems like there are probably about 10,000 people in 5 different Colorado warehouses who are subject to these requirements and looking for compensation under the law.
Do you know what it is here in Illinois? I imagine that if it's happening there, there's some people out there that are like, yeah, you know, I sometimes have to wait 15, 20, 30 minutes for this thing to get done. I should be able to get paid for this.
Definitely. There's laws here in Illinois, state law, as well as the federal law, which governs payment for wages when you do work. So both of those laws would apply here and in Colorado, where the lawsuit was filed. State law is a little bit different in every state, but the federal law is the same everywhere.
I got a question for you, and I didn't prep you for this. So, and I don't know, or I'll get back to you, is 100% acceptable, because I don't like putting anyone on the spot. But there was a recent meme that went around from a bar that was trying to recruit talent to work at the bartenders. And of course, there's a labor shortage right now, and I know there's a lot of bars and restaurants struggling. And they were wanting to put potential bartenders through an unpaid training session that was an entire shift, 6 to 8 hours long, as a training, unpaid, to see if they would get the job or not. And there was this huge generational divide arguing online. A lot of people saying, yeah, you got to prove yourself to get that job. But a lot of people were saying, unpaid, if you're going to have me work even for a training shift or an audition, you got to pay me for that. Do you know what the laws here are in Illinois in terms of training someone for the job?
I don't know that specific answer to your specific question, but look, the law is in place to make sure that when people are required to do an indispensable thing for their job, they get paid for that work so that there is no free labor. And if an argument can be made that those bartenders or folks who are being put through the shift, that training requirement is an essential part of their job, then under the law, they should get paid.
Yeah, I think that's what most people argue, too. I'll have to follow up with you there when I don't put you on the spot live on the radio. Jeff, thanks for navigating that question for us. I wanted to talk about this Tesla case. A California jury awarded a $137 million verdict against Tesla in a racial discrimination case that was brought by a black contract worker. It's a huge verdict. I don't know if that's going to be what it ends up. But, Jeffrey, these sorts of cases don't often see public eye, do they?
They don't. You're right about that, John. A lot of large employers, and in particularly employers out in San Francisco, California, use arbitration clauses to keep these types of disputes inside private arbitration rather than publicly accessible in the court system. So this case is a bit of an outlier.
$137 million is a lot of money. And you mentioned that arbitration. There was another case with Tesla where a worker complained about similar things, being called racial epithets and stuff like that. And he won $1 million in arbitration. A lot of people say that's a slap on the wrist to Tesla, but $137 million certainly is a big amount. Is that amount likely to be reduced through appeals? I know Tesla can probably gummy the works here and make this case last a lot longer.
You're right, John. I think that there's probably a good chance that that $137 million verdict gets reduced. I think the things to know about it is that, number one, $130 million was assessed as punitive damages against Tesla. That certainly says something about how egregious or reprehensible the conduct was, that the jury thought that number was sufficient to send Tesla a message about their conduct. But the second thing to know, I suppose, is that the Supreme Court has ruled that punitive damages can only be so much. Otherwise, it would be considered to be unfair punishment. And typically, punitive damages are limited to 10 times what is awarded for compensatory damages. So in this case, the plaintiff was awarded about $6.9 million. And I would think that the $130 million punitive damage award would be reduced to approximately 10 times the compensatory damages, or roughly $69 million, which is not too bad.
No, still a lot of money, of course. I just want to know your opinion. If someone out there is listening and they feel like they've been harassed because of their race, sex, orientation, whatever, at work, what sorts of steps should someone take to, you know, potentially, you know, sue their employer or at least advance a case along if they really feel like it's affected them?
What I think was so significant about this case and why the damages awarded were so significant is that the plaintiff had documented all these different events of misconduct due to race, swastikas being drawn, racial epithets in bathrooms, derogatory characters, and the employee had created a record of letting HR know what was happening, and still, apparently, nothing was done about it. So I do think that the best advice to give folks who are in that position is to keep a careful record of what you see, when you see it, and make sure that you let HR know so that it can be fixed. If it's not fixed, then it's time to see a lawyer.
Crazy story out of the NBA world. 18 former players named in an indictment about defrauding the NBA's health insurance plan. I don't know why a millionaire would want to do that. I guess greed begets greed. Allegedly, I should say. Of course, they haven't had their day in court yet. Do you see healthcare scams happen in employees, the employee-employer relationship often, Jeff?
Several times, it's clear that employees get a reputation for submitting overstated claims.
Okay.
What I think makes the NBA case so remarkable was these former NBA players designed a whole scheme to trick a health benefit fund to pay claims for medical services that they could not have possibly received. In one case, or in several cases, the defendants were in locations other than where the doctors were at the time that they were getting medical treatment. I believe that the FBI found that one of the players was actually playing basketball in Taiwan when he submitted a bill for getting dental services in California. that is not common.
Yeah, I imagine so, because I think if people would, you know, if you're going to try and fool your employer out of money, at least be a little bit more careful than that. And obviously, don't do that. But I was just surprised at the breadth of this of the case and how it was caught down. In fact, some of the invoices had, like, terrible grammar on it and things along those lines. You'd think you'd have a proofreader if you're going to allegedly commit this crime, as the prosecutors say these NBA players did. Well, Jeffrey, as always, it's great to chat with you. If anyone has employment questions, what's the best way to reach you?
You can reach me at my website, ColinMashapinto and ColinLLP.com.
All right. Sounds good. Jeffrey, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John. Talk to you again soon.
As always, Let's Get Legal Here, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I see John from Wisconsin on the line wondering about a company paying for the training. Iridian, let's go ahead and get John's number, and we can maybe connect him with Jeffrey, because that's certainly going to be something that Jeffrey will handle way better than I will be able to, but we're running up against the news time. Okay, coming up a little bit later on this hour, we'll have another question of the day, and after the news, we're going to chat with Nora Devine from the Devine Law Group about all things residential and commercial property taxes. It's that time of season, especially if you live in the Chicago area. What you shouldn't do if you have any question or any doubt that you're paying too much for property or commercial real estate taxes, whatever the case may be, keep tuned here, because Nora Devine is going to answer some of your questions after the news here on WGN. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. So excited to have back on the program Nora Devine from the Devine Law Group. Nora, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thanks for having me again.
It is, is it ever not tax season? I think we're always thinking about taxes, but for a lot of Cook County folks, they're either they just got their tax bill, and a lot of assessments are happening, so things must be getting busy for you.
Yeah, it's funny. In a lot of states, my job doesn't even exist because they don't rely on the property tax to fund the schools. But in Illinois, there's a lot of people that do my job. And when I started doing this job 17 years ago, everybody sort of had summers off. It was kind of understood that it wasn't going to be much going on in the summer in the way of reassessments and appeals. And now that's completely different. It's really more of a year-round thing these days. The assessor this year compared to the last 3 years, 5 years is running actually way behind. He's about 5 months behind.
Why is that?
It seems to be they switched over from their mainframe to a new computer system. Mm-hmm. And when you're dealing with any kind of big data and big processes, I imagine there can be all kinds of hang-ups with that. So I assume that that's a big part of the story.
All right. A lot of people are getting their assessments right now. How does that work? I mean, I know it's done every 3 years in the city, right?
So, yeah, this year, the entire city of Chicago is being reassessed. That would be West Township, North Township, Rogers Park, Lakeview, Jefferson Park, things like that, South Township, Hyde Park Township. And they're getting reassessed this year. Next year, the north and northwest suburbs will be reassessed, affecting the taxes due and payable the following year. And then the next year after that, it's the south and southwest suburbs. And it seems, though, that I think I'm starting to get the picture. I'm starting to have a hunch that this particular administration would like to go more toward annual assessments, where they're kind of reevaluating and changing the values sort of every year.
That seems more messy to me.
Well, I mean,
or is it more accurate and you might get more tax revenue from it?
There's an argument for it. Mm-hmm. That, you know, to take a 3-year median of sales, you know, the market can change much faster up or down within that very long 3-year time span. We've seen it do so in the last, you know, in recent memory. So there is some argument in favor of it. Whether we're ready for it, to me at this moment, judging on all the things I've seen in the last few months, it seems like that would be trying to run before you can walk.
Right.
So we've seen a lot of difficulty with getting the townships published. They're recalling townships. They're changing the numbers. They're republishing them. So a lot of the attorneys that do closings and transactions, and I don't do that work, but I do advise a lot of these folks, and they're saying, like, what do you think about this proration for this deal or this proration for that deal? And I'm telling them all, don't rely on any of these numbers right now. Because for the first time since I've been doing this and the first time since anybody's been doing this, these numbers aren't reliable once they're published. They've been pulled back and changed. So mm-hmm. It's been It's been more exciting than usual, I would say, this year.
As exciting as property taxes and commercial taxes can get. Obviously, you love it. 312-981-7200. That's the phone line. And, Nora, you're going to answer people's questions if they have any. 312-981-7200. The first question I have, just generally speaking, about when someone should call you is, when should someone call you? It's not, oh, my gosh, look at this bill I have to pay for the last year. At that point, that bill, you're going to have to pay that.
Yeah, it depends what state you're in. If you're in Indiana and you see a bill, that's actually your trigger to appeal the assessment at the time, believe it or
really?
Not. Really? It's not that way in Illinois. In Illinois, you want to act when you get that reassessment notice. You have a 30-day period to appeal to the assessor in Cook County. And then after that, the Board of Review opens sometime down the road and will open for that township for appeals. And the role of the Board of Review is to provide an independent review of the assessor's values.
Did you say 30 days?
Yeah, well, 30 days to appeal to the assessor. That's why everybody thinks that they have this huge time crunch and appeal deadline. But in reality, when we're looking at the numbers for where the relief was issued the last year or two, by far the Board of Review was the one that was issuing the reductions. And it seemed to many that the assessor wasn't actually even reviewing the appeals that were submitted there. So it's not a big deal if you miss the assessor's appeal window. You can definitely still go to the Board of Review when they open for that township.
Mm-hmm. 312-981-7200 if you've got questions. Nora Devine from the Devine Law Group. You can go to DevineLawGroup.com for more. Is there a good phone number you want people to call, or just want them to go to the website first? Because you answer a lot of great questions there.
Yeah, the website's pretty comprehensive, and there's a really good intake form. It doesn't require a ton of information, and you know, your email address, your PIN number, and your county, because we do cover the entire state of Illinois, all 102 counties. So we do happy to review anything that comes our way, give people a little bit of advice. The further outside of Cook County you are, the more accurate you find the assessors will be, because they're dealing with smaller jurisdictions and you know, don't have as many challenging valuation problems as we do have down here. So mm-hmm.
All right, so you attached a study in this email, which you could probably break down a lot more than I can, but basically it talks about this shift in Cook County's property tax burden and how COVID-19 and some changes made have really changed the burden. Where is the burden shifting from and to?
Well, it doesn't seem like it's a secret anymore that this assessor's policy intention is to alleviate homeowner tax bills and to shift the tax bill burden over to the commercial taxpayers. So it's been said.
Off the top of my head, that sounds great, right? I think a lot of people think that sounds great.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I don't have to pay as high taxes. Okay. Problem is.
Yeah, and the problem is the job creators, and you know, we're number 49 on a list of 50 states in terms of fiscal health, and we're number 2 highest property taxes already. And you know, it makes a difference when people are deciding where to put their corporate headquarters, where they're going to put a distribution center, or where they're going to put a new office building, or whether they're going to invest in Chicago or the state of Illinois. So there is this delicate balance, and it's not unique to this area. It goes on all over the country and all over the world in terms of who's going to pay what.
How much of a shift are we talking here?
The study is a little bit fuzzy in the way that it's just taking an average tax rate for the entire county, and I don't think that's the best methodology, just because the highest tax rate is somewhere around 35%, and that's down in the southwest suburbs somewhere, south suburbs, and here in the city of Chicago, the tax rate may be more like 6.7. So to just
for residents,
no, for the local tax rate.
Okay,
yeah. So you take your assessment times the equalizer times the tax rate. So you have this wide variation countywide on how big your local tax rate can be. So just taking an average of those is not quite a great method. But when they were ballparking it, they were saying about $1.2 billion. It's probably more. And you know, that's the problem really with what happened was that the assessor was about to publish the values for 2020, and the pandemic shutdown happened in March, and he's getting ready to publish, and he decided, oh, I must do something. And so what he did was he issued these quote-unquote COVID reductions to all the residential properties, and they were done in a way that wasn't quite in line with what the market ended up doing. So if you're taking all residential real estate, you're knocking it down 8 to 12%. And then what really happens is that residential real estate increases 20% in
right.
the area.
Now so he the assessor, with good intentions, trying to say, hey, we'll
good
try.
Good intentions for some.
For some. We're going to try to alleviate people. It's COVID.
I know, but the state of Illinois has a constitutional provision, which I think is pretty wise in how it was drafted. And it says that if you're going to classify property for real estate tax purposes, which is what we do in Cook County, you can't have the highest taxed grouping of properties assessed more than 2.5 times what the lowest is assessed at.
Okay.
So if a residential house can be assessed at 10% of its value, you can't have a situation where a commercial property is being assessed more than 2.5 times that, so more than 25% of its value.
Uh-huh.
And when you look at the studies that came out from the state of Illinois' Department of Revenue, you can see that the residential really did dip below the requirements of that ratio. So I imagine that several clever attorneys, including myself, will be making arguments on behalf of these commercial taxpayers that this was a violation of the 2.5-to-1 ratio provision in the Illinois Constitution. So I do feel for all of the commercial taxpayers, the industrial taxpayers. I think that there's a reason why we don't want to completely shove the burden over to them, because the framers of our state constitution wisely knew that we can't kill the golden goose. We need industry here.
Right. Nora Devine knows what she's talking about, people. Boy, I could dive into this deeply, but let's get some callers too, some texters, 312-981-7200. If you have a personal question about a tax bill that you've gotten here in Cook County, or really all the counties in Illinois, right?
Yeah, we cover the whole state.
The whole state, 312-981-7200. Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. We'll continue after this. This is Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Nora Devine here, talking about all things tax. How'd you get into tax law, by the way, Nora?
Well, I was working for a real estate developer, and he did not enjoy responding to all the inquiries that were coming from the property tax firm that he was using at the time. So he made me do all that, and among all kinds of other random building management types of functions. And so I was responding to all of these, and got really familiar with the forms. And then somebody suggested that maybe I should do an internship at the Cook County State's Attorney's Office in the Civil Division, which I did. At the time, my father-in-law was the state's attorney, and he didn't know who I was at the time or anything, but I showed him recently my old ID, and it was kind of funny because now, he's my father-in-law. But at the time, so I only did a summer there, but apparently after you spend time in that particular internship, the universe will not allow you to be anything other than a property tax attorney. Everybody that was wanting to hire me or wanting to know what my next move was interested, wanted me to go in that direction, and
yeah.
They were willing to pay me quite a bit more than the other sort of clerkships that were available to me at the time. So, and then I was good at it, and I kind of liked it, and there was a lot of room for professionalizing the practice at the time. It was very clout based back then, and it was the work product was slight, and it was just a really good opportunity to kind of take a practice area and try to make it a little bit more professional,
yeah.
I would say. And that we've seen that trend as the people have developed on the government side, and different politicians have taken different offices, and then as people have developed on the private side, the work product's much more impressive. The arguments that are being advanced are a lot better than I would say they were 17
okay.
years ago.
There you go. I've got a lot of questions on the text line. Dan wants to know about what percentage of people that come to you for help end up getting a lower tax bill.
Well, so a lower tax bill, lower than what?
Before, I guess you said. But I guess
yeah.
taxes are always going to go up.
So the way we look at our work is we're trying to make your tax bill be lower than it otherwise would have been had you not appealed. And because we do have this 3-year reassessment timeline right now, there is a lag there. So if the market's on the way up, 3 years in a row, and then you get your reassessment notice, your taxes may be scheduled to go up 50%, but you get somebody to appeal, and now they've only gone up 10%. So the way that you asked me the question was, can you make my bill lower, and how many times can you make it lower? And the truth is, since the real estate market has generally been inclining over the past several decades, and because the cost of running government, particularly funding our pension liabilities, has increased and really ballooned, the whole down trend is really not something
right.
that someone should be expecting right now. We need a big change to happen with our pension financials before we can expect any kind of relief on the property tax side, or the government needs to start taxing something else.
Right.
And if you talk about taxing retirement income, everyone, their hair lights on fire. Or you talk about taxing services. And look, we talked about taxing pop. Look what happened there. I mean,
right. But so, I guess to Dave's question then, what percentage of clients or ish get
some relief?
Some relief.
So we aren't allowed to file cases that don't have merit. So,
okay.
You know, right there, we have a lot of conversations with taxpayers where we tell them that they're actually in good shape and there's probably not much we can do. And for the ones that we do take on, the success rate's got to be higher than 95%.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You wouldn't do it if you didn't.
And so that's the kind of brilliance of being a specialist, is that you get very, very acquainted with what is possible and what is not. And it's not that we don't try novel arguments. We do. You know, we're always trying to see if everything that worked last year is still working this year, and if something that might not have worked in the past might work this year. So it's not that we don't, you know, run things up the flagpole in hopes for adjusting the way that cases are analyzed. But in general, if a case doesn't have merit, we're telling the taxpayer they're in good shape.
Well, Diane even asked here on the text line, she says, I don't want to waste your time, but can anyone ask you for...
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
We're set up. I mean, we invested heavily in technology. We have a custom database. We rent the assessor's bulk data in Cook County, which is not cheap to do. And I have a highly trained staff. So it doesn't take us very much time at all, based on maybe 5 data points to be able to look around the neighborhood, see what's going on, look at the sales. We have access to the multiple listing service, things like that. So it's pretty quick for us to tell you whether or not you have something there.
Is that online? They submit that information?
Yeah, we have an intake form on the website.
Yeah, okay. See, this is the thing. Everybody in the world right now, at least here in Illinois that's listening, go to the Devine Law Group, DEVINE, right. lawgroup.com. Might as well plug in and see what you get, right?
Yeah, I mean, if there's some angle there, we will let you know.
That's what I like about it. Let's go on the phone lines. We got Tom calling from Forest Park. Hey, Tom.
Hey, and I thought Karen Conti had all the answers.
No, I got some.
Know how to pick the attorneys.
Yeah, there you go.
Let me have a question for you. I'm in a 96-unit condominium complex in Forest Park. And I was wondering, when we collectively protest the taxes, if you will, are we looking on a commercial scale or on a residential scale rate on that protest?
So you're assessed at a 10% value factor. So if your condo was worth $100,000, your assessed value should be $10,000. And so when you're appealing as a condo building, your representative that's representing the condo association would be looking at sales in the building, looking at sales in buildings nearby, and then trying to make the best argument they can in terms of what the overall value of the building should be. And then what they do is they ask the board of review to break down by percentage of unit ownership how that value should be allocated to each unit. I don't think that answers your question, though.
But it's residential.
Yeah, it's a residential appeal. But what do you mean about rate?
Well, in terms of the factor per unit, is it a fair assessment across the board given the recent sales, if you will? I mean,
I do. I'm looking at my friend's building right now out this beautiful, stunning window. I mean, this is amazing. I have a great view of the Ferris wheel at Navy Pier. And I have a friend who has like a 3-bedroom unit in this building right over here at 345 East North Water Street, and he wants to maybe opt out of his group appeal because he's just getting the sense that he might be able to kind of dial in the value a little bit better on his own than if he's looped in with the other, because his unit's, you know, not the same as everybody else's and things like that. So there are times when it does make sense to opt out of the group appeal, but, you know, most of the time it makes sense to stay in the group appeal.
Tom, we got to go into the news, but feel free, of course, to reach out. Yeah, thank you very much for the phone call. Nora, this went by so fast. We got a bunch of text questions about what's the most difficult county to deal with. Oh. Can you answer that within 10 seconds?
10 seconds. Since I teach for the Illinois Property Assessment Institute, I try really hard not to offend the assessing officials.
Let's do that.
I have some that shall not be named.
Okay, we'll talk about that off air. Exactly. Nora Devine, this was really great. I hope you come back again because a lot of people have questions. But really, go to thedevinelawgroup.com for more information and to plug that stuff in. We'll talk to you soon, Nora. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
More Let's Get Legal after the news coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Thank you very much, Kevin. 407 here on WGN. We got another hour of Let's Get Legal powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. And trust me, people. Ooh, I used the word trust even to tease that segment. Didn't even plan on doing that. I've been talking with John Heggie during the news break from Walkner Law, and I have learned so much in 4 minutes, and I'm excited for you to learn it too. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking about wills, trusts, and plenty more coming up on Let's Get Legal. Speaking of Walkner Law Firm, we've got John Heggie joining us. John, it's good to see you again, my friend.
Wonderful to see you, John.
On a gorgeous day, too.
Oh, my gosh. It's beautiful out there.
I'm going to give away the phone number now, 312-981-7200, because I think people are going to have interesting questions about wills and trusts. And I, you know, and we've even talked before about the differences between wills and trusts a bit, and we're going to recap it. But there's a lot of people that probably really don't have much of an idea of what happens to their assets after they pass away. Would you say that's a fair assessment, that a lot of people just assume something's going to happen, it'll get taken care of, and boy, their descendants are going to find out that's not the case?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the real tragedy. People are sad, they're grieving, and then they find out they've got all this work, this complete mess of a financial situation, all because nobody took a little time to plan.
Mm-hmm. Do you think there's people out there that think they're in good shape, and if they were to talk to you, you might say, hey, you're not in as good a shape in terms of how these things are going to be handled after you pass as you might think you are?
Well, definitely. And I think a lot of people might be under the under the misconception that a will takes care of everything.
Right.
Now, a will is certainly better than not having anything.
Right. And let's define these things a little bit for people to understand. A will is where you say, this is what I have, and here's who's getting this, right? I'm breaking this up. The house is going to this, or the house is getting split amongst the children. The jewelry I have in the thing, that's what a will is, right?
Yeah, very much. So that concept goes back to the times of kings and queens. You know, we all kind of get that idea. You write down, you give your last will and testament. You know, it's all very stately, and the word goes out. But what I think people don't know is that when you have that will, it still has to go to court. To probate court, and the judge oversees that. And that's a good thing. Like, most likely things will go the way you want, but going to probate itself is a lengthy process, you know, well over 6 months, and it's expensive. There are court fees, you know, in Cook County, you know, you're looking at $1,000
just off the bat,
just the first day. And that doesn't even account your attorney time,
right?
Which is not cheap either,
right?
And that's, you know, that's in-person court time. That's the most expensive time that an attorney would charge. So, you know, a will is good. It's good to have it. But if you're really serious about it, you should have a trust.
Okay. So what is a trust?
So a trust is a contract. It's you enter a legal contract with yourself. You're the grantor. You create the trust. You make yourself the trustee. You make yourself the beneficiary. And the things that you own, instead of being in your name, become in the trust name.
They're in like a bubble.
Right. It's a bubble that follows you around. It's a wagon you pull around, and
okay,
you put all your things into that bubble or that wagon or whatever else you want to call it.
And so you still own everything.
Your trust owns everything.
But
right.
You're the That's trustee. The so
you're the trustee. You're the beneficiary. Your life doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just change your hat once in a while from you as a person to you as a trustee. And then when you pass away, that trust still exists. That, you know, that bubble's still there. That wagon's still there. And then where those things go are governed by the contract that you wrote with yourself. And it never goes to court. And it passes very quickly. And it doesn't involve all those costs. And certainly doesn't involve all that time. Because it's your trust. You get to write the rules.
Now, one thing that sounds complicated to me, though, is let's say I have that wagon or bubble. Which one do you want to go with? You like wagon better?
I can go either way, John.
So you have everything in the wagon and you pass away. Is it as simple as the wagon then gets handed off to someone else who, oh boy, I've inherited this mess? Or no, it's a little bit easier to navigate that.
It's so much easier. It's hard to even put it into words. Because your trust says who the next person is going to be in control of these things. Your successor trustee. And the successor trustee reads the trust and says, oh, when this person passes away, they said to do X, Y, and Z. So then the trustee does X, Y, and Z. They give the money to the kids. They give it to a charity. Whatever the rules that you set up that you want to happen.
They have to follow that.
They have to follow that.
Okay, so then, and that X, Y, Z is a lot of the things that I think people put into the will, but then now you've avoided the probate court.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the idea of trust are probably it's a little bit of an esoteric idea to wrap your head around. But it's also something that's generally, in generations past, been reserved for, you know, extremely wealthy families, mm-hmm. and wealthy people.
It sounds fancy.
Oh, yes, very much so. Mm-hmm. But in reality, just the average person, it's cheaper to do a trust than it is to do a will and go through probate, you know, at the end cost.
Why don't people do it? Is it because they don't know the benefits? They think it is for the ultra wealthy? Does it take a little bit more on the front end?
It does take a little more on the front end because you have to pay an attorney to draft the trust. You have to, you know, make sure your assets are in that trust name. So there, you know, there's a little bit of legwork and a little bit of financial commitment up front, but the total commitment is less than what a will and probate will cost in the long run. And definitely, I think people think that trusts are reserved for the Rockefellers or the Pritzkers or, you know, the families as such. But, you know, it really applies to almost every single person, particularly if you own a piece of real estate of any size or shape. You should have a trust.
Okay. 312-981-7200 if you have specific questions or general questions about wills versus trusts. We're going to get to more of that. 312-981-7200. If someone has to run around right now, WochnerLawFirm.com is where they can reach you, right?
Absolutely. We're there.
WOCHNER LawFirm.com. More with John after this on WGN. 720 WGN. It's 420 in the afternoon on this warm Saturday in October. Gorgeous day, John Heggie, huh?
Just beautiful out
just
there.
Beautiful. And we're talking about wills and trusts and the differences between them and what information you need to be armed with. Got a great text from the 224 area code wondering, does the firm that Walker Law Firm do special needs trusts? Can you explain what that is and if you guys do that?
Oh, yeah, we certainly do. So a special needs trust would be a receptacle, so to speak, to hold cash or, you know, any other asset that someone might leave, someone who has a special need, who at some point in their life might need state aid.
Okay.
So, you know, if someone needed state aid and say it was a large financial amount and someone wanted to gift them, you know, a smaller financial amount out of their estate, you know, that money could be lost because it would ultimately, the state wants as much money as they can
right.
back. So a special need trust would shelter a gift towards a person who might need state aid at some point in their life.
Okay. Sounds good. And you guys handle those?
Sure.
All right.
Any of your trust lawyers can do that.
Sounds good. Let's go to Ruben. Ruben, you're on WGN. Hey, Ruben.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. You got a question for John?
Yes. I was just wondering, I've been trying to figure out about IRA accounts. Can those be put in trust also?
Can they be put in a trust, an IRA account?
So technically, you know, an IRA and a 401k, those are tax-deferred vehicles. So, you know, that's the whole point of them. It's a way for your money to grow without having to pay the taxes on that up front. But Uncle Sam ultimately is going to want that money.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't title an IRA or a 401k into the name of a trust. You could make the trust the beneficiary of that IRA, and sometimes that makes sense and sometimes it doesn't.
So meaning that the trust is off to one side, the IRA is, you know, you're continuing to gain value in the IRA or the 401k, mm-hmm. and then when the payout time comes for you to start getting payments on those, it pays the trust instead.
Yeah, you could do that. There are some circumstances where that's the way to go. There's been some change in tax law recently where it's not always a slam dunk like it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But for sure, when you have the trust and someone inherits an IRA and that person has a trust, they can take the proceeds of that and put it into the trust and still get all the protection of the trust.
So, that makes sense. Ruben, does that make sense to answer your question?
Kind of, yeah. A little confusing, but yeah. So the trust themselves can be, or the IRA can be the beneficiary of the trust.
So it can pay into the trust, but you don't take the account and you put it in the trust. Am I understanding that, John?
Right, because ultimately the tax has to be due. The owner of an IRA has to be a natural person who can pay the taxes when those taxes come due. But the benefit of that IRA can go into a trust or it can go to a person who then puts it in their trust.
That makes sense. Ruben, that seems to clear it up a little bit. Thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you.
Absolutely. 312-981-7200 if you have questions about wills and trusts. Had a question from the 312. You kind of touched on this in the last segment. Is there a minimum amount of what your estate has to be worth to set up a trust?
Well, I don't think there's any hard and fast rules. And
right.
I think that's a point that people don't quite think. Like, oh, it doesn't apply to me. I've only got $10,000. Well, you know, I mean, maybe for $10,000 or less. But, you know, whatever the value of your estate is, if it's worth it to avoid probate, i.e. spending, you know, $3,000-$4,000 in probate plus the time, it's worth it having a trust. It's really not for ultra wealthy people only. It's mm-hmm. for every, you know, this is very much for the everyman.
Especially middle class Americans, for sure.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of curious about if you have any idea or sense of the percentages of people that A, do nothing and leave everything to, boy, a real messy situation versus wills and versus trust. Do you have any sense of, based on, I don't know whether it's out of Illinoisans or Americans in general, about who does what?
So, you know, there's always, you know, trade association yeah. numbers floating around out there. So, you know, I really couldn't say it with any divinity, but, you know, the consensus is it's well over half do nothing.
Are you kidding?
It's unbelievable. And, you know, it's a tragedy. I mean, there are assets that don't get passed from generation to generation because nobody does what is essence? Some paperwork.
Yeah. Is it because it's an unfortunate thing to think about? Do you think that scares people away from dealing with it?
Well, I wouldn't delve into the world of psychology, but...
Come on, John. Do it with me.
I'm sure that's got something to do with it. It's not fun. You know, our last segment was about taxes. Yeah. This segment's about death. I mean, what's going on here? I mean, this is a rough Saturday afternoon on a beautiful day.
On a beautiful 80-degree day. Nothing but death and taxes. That is sure right. 847 wants to know, is there an age in which someone should consider starting their trust?
Very much, it's the old adage, you know, the best day to start a trust is 10 years ago,
right.
And the second best day is today.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't put a number on it, but earlier the better. And if you don't have it, it's...
Major life events, you have kids, stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You want to have all that in place.
Yeah, I agree with that. All right, let's go to Darlene. Is it Darlene? You're on WGN. Hey, Darlene.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. You got a question?
Yes, my father, when he passed, he had his money in trust for my sister and brother and I. But when they passed, their kids went to the lawyer, and they said, we don't take trust. So they split the money between the six kids, her husband's kids and hers. But my dad just wanted it to go to my sister's family.
Huh, that seems okay.
I can't believe that when they said we don't do trust, why they didn't go to a different lawyer or something. They didn't use the trust that has been in for years.
That's interesting. I know that's a specific example. John, I don't know if you have any comment or have heard of similar things.
Well, you know, yeah, I'd have to review what that trust initially said, but yeah, something it does sound odd.
A little odd, yeah. Darling, I don't think we have an answer for you, but you can contact, where do people reach out to you, John, by the way?
WagnerLawFirm.com. That'll have our contact email and phone number.
Yeah, darling, that does sound a little bit messy. Maybe consider reaching out to John and he can help you sort that out. Okay, Darlene?
Okay.
Yeah,
thank you so much.
Yeah, have a good day. Let's go to Alan. Alan, you're on WGN. Hey, Alan.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, of course. What do you got for us?
I recently became the successor trustee of a person who passed away. Who mm-hmm. oversees that I do my job?
Interesting question, John.
So how it works is ultimately the beneficiaries have a right to, you know, certain things from you, like an accounting and, you know, just kind of a heads up on what's happening. And they have a right to see that, you know, you are indeed the legally appointed successor trustee. So that's the main enforcement mechanism is the beneficiaries.
So they could say, I don't think this person's doing what they should do. And then does it go to the court of law? Does it go to court or is it arbitration? How does that work?
Well, there's a few avenues that gotta go if things go badly.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, things don't go badly. And I'm sure our caller here.
Yeah, Alan, you're not going to do anything bad, right?
No. I just was curious if there was a court review of what I did.
No, generally not. So that's kind of the point of all this, is it stays outside of the system, it stays private, it moves quickly and less expensively.
All right, sounds good. Alan, thanks for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
312-981-7200. 262 wants to know, can you discuss when to use a transfer on death deed as part of an estate plan? I don't know what any of that means. Can you tell us, John?
Yeah. So it's a transfer on death instrument. It's generally what we call it here in Illinois. And it's something that you would file for a piece of real estate with the recorder of deeds of whatever county that you're in. And it says, upon my death, I want to transfer this piece of property, you know, that you identify with the PIN number and all such things, to this named beneficiary. So that's another great tool to avoid probate for a piece of property.
Okay.
You know, and then you can be, you know, rest assured it'll pass to who you want.
And you can help people out with that sort of stuff?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, great, great, great. Hey, we got Kathy on WGN. Kathy, we only got about a minute and a half. What's your question? Kathy?
Hi. I was just turning my radio off.
Oh, thank you, Kathy. I appreciate that.
Said it there. Okay. I made out a will, but I just named some beneficiaries in my will, but I have an annuity, a couple, two IRAs, and I have people listed as beneficiaries on that, and I don't own any property. So the only things that I own are like a car and various things because I rent.
Mm-hmm.
Do I really need a trust, or if I die, will the beneficiaries receive the payment from the IRAs, and then they pay the taxes?
Great question. Yeah, Kathy, I'm going to put you on hold here and let John answer the question. We've got about 30 seconds, generally speaking.
So I'd love to talk to you personally, Kathy. I'll get your number. We'll take care of that.
Yeah.
But in general, yeah, if you have an avenue for all of your assets to go, if you've named a beneficiary, you know, like with an IRA account or any other sort of thing that happens upon your passing, this asset goes somewhere, yeah, you can avoid probate. So you may or may not need a trust. Generally, a trust would be better, but there could be exceptions.
All right, Iridian, if you don't mind writing down Kathy's information, John, you'll follow up with her. And if anyone has more, they can go to WochnerLawFirm.com, WochnerLawFirm.com. John, so great to chat with you.
Oh, well, great to see you, John.
We're just scratching the surface here. We look forward to seeing you again, okay?
Absolutely.
Death and taxes here on Let's Get Legal. Well, after the news, we're going to talk about eviction moratorium. Boy, a pleasant show here
keeps
today.
Getting better.
Hey, these are important things people need to know about. Take care, John.
All right.
We'll talk more after the news on WGN. 720 WGN. Yeah, Peter Greenberg coming up at 5 o'clock. I chatted with him yesterday on Chicago's Afternoon News. We talked a lot about the deals that are still out there for a little bit longer because things are definitely getting a little bit back to normal. And what Peter's going to talk about coming up around 5 o'clock is also going to be one that I just hadn't even thought about, the idea that now, very soon, Europeans and some folks from Asia are going to be able to come to the United States with a proof of a vaccination, that they also, of course, are going to travel within the country. So air travel as a whole will be picking up, not just from domestic travelers traveling domestically, but also international travelers once they get here. And as they transverse and explore our great country, a lot of them, of course, take to the air. It's a little bit harder to get from LA to California than it is maybe to get on a train in certain parts of Europe. So they're going to be flying a little bit more, so things are going to get a little more crowded. Then we got Blackhawks hockey. And just a little heads up for folks, if you don't know, I get to do the hosting of the Blackhawks games in arena with Jenna Rose, my great partner. And we do all the games from Section 312 and all over the place. You're always welcome, if you're at the United Center attending a Blackhawks game, to come up to Section 312. If you're nearby, pop on over to us. You'll see us. We got the microphones and such. Say hello and say you're a Let's Get Legal listener. I'll give you a good old high five or a fist bump, and certainly appreciate that. 312-981-7200. We're going to be talking about the Illinois eviction moratorium in just a little bit. But I got another question of the day for you, a little trivia here for you. Earlier, I asked you four states, Alaska, Vermont, Hawaii, and Maine, were the only four states that banned what? And Frankie on the South Side had the answer of billboards. So here is your second trivia question. 312-981-7200 if you've got a guess. In 2006, about 76,000 people did this during that year. 10 years later, about 44,000 Americans did this. What am I talking about? In 2006, 76,000 people a year did this in our country. And 10 years later, that number had fallen to 44,000 Americans doing what in a single year? That's very vague, and I know you're not going to know the answer from that right away, but 312-981-7200 if you have any guesses about this change. And keep in mind, this is a legal show. That's kind of your hint, so that might be able to help you out. 312-981-7200 if you can guess what 76,000 people did in 2006 that only 44,000 people did in 2016, a few years later. But let's talk about the Illinois eviction moratorium, and we're going to try and tackle this from a couple different sides. And first off, we have an attorney that represents a lot of folks, a lot of tenants who might be in trouble. Attorney Nicholas Bailey joins us now. Nicholas, thanks for hopping on with us.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. The eviction moratorium expired here in Illinois. I don't believe it was extended. I was trying to see. So I think as of right now, we are back to the pre-pandemic situation. First of all, is that correct? Is that evictions can continue again?
The moratorium is has expired. It was not renewed by Governor Pritzker. And so they're starting to pick up, and I'm sure it's going to be a lot a heavy lift on the court system there, but they are going to get it rolling. They're going to start, evictions are going to start up again. Evictions have been continuing in a very limited capacity, even during the moratorium. But in general, yeah, it's the moratorium is over, and there's going to be a large backlog of evictions.
What can tenants do? I mean, what safeguards do they have? Do they have any protection? Is there money available to them that, to help out? I know that's a loaded question, but where do we start with that?
There's a lot of answers there. I guess I'll cut right to the most important one. There is there money available? Yes. There's, you know, knowing that this wave of evictions is coming, there's a lot of independent as well as federal and state programs. You can, one place to start is this Chicago.gov, just the city website. There's a lot of information because of the changing process. And then also IllinoisRentalAssistance.org. Those are two different programs, the two different resources for that's rental assistance. This is, so moving back, I'd say that the most important thing to do is get involved in the process. If you, if you're in a eviction situation where that is happening or might be happening, tenants need to get ahead of the ball there, because it's really easy. People call my office often far too late in the situation where they've gotten paperwork and avoided court because they thought there was some sort of error in the paperwork and they didn't have to show up. Basically, if you let the landlord go to court and you avoid court, there's only one side of the story there.
Mm-hmm.
You have a lot of rights and protections, but you can't make use of any of them if you just avoid the process.
So you need to show up to court.
Yes, and you know, as soon as this starts, you should start looking into resources because you're showing up to court is good. Showing up to court with a lawyer is better.
Yeah,
and I'm not just, you know, saying that for myself. there's a lot of resources. You know, my office, we usually don't represent just eviction defendants, but the LCBH, the Lawyers Committee for Better Housing, they're a great resource for people that are facing evictions. Their number is 312-347-7600. That's the Lawyers Committee for Better Housing. They are a great resource before you get to court. You don't want to go to court, lose, and then call a lawyer, which happens a lot. And again, the paperwork, a lot of times people, they get paperwork posted to their door, so they think it wasn't given to them, or the name is wrong or something like that, and they think they can somehow gain an advantage by throwing that out. I mean, if you have paperwork and there is an error, save it and give it to a lawyer. Lawyer can use that. That's evidence. But, you know, if you just throw it away, the landlord can say that the paper said whatever. And, you know, that's the court date that you need to know. Court right now is all through Zoom. You can do it. You can call in. There's a lot of resources out there, but you have to get ahead of it. It's way easier to avoid the problem in the first place, to respond before the eviction is entered, rather than fixing it afterwards. The courts are very hesitant to revisit once they've already entered the eviction. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, do you recommend, even before getting to that, that people talk to their landlords and see if there's compromises or payment plans that can be worked out? Or we will?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those resources I gave out too. You know, at the end of the day, the landlord's trying to get paid. If they can get paid through the state government, that usually will solve any problem. You know, they're getting their money, and that's enough for them. So communicate with the landlord. If the landlord promises you anything, you know, keep it in writing. You know, if they're making some offer, you want to document it. You know, that's, you know, from a lawyer's perspective, that's always what I want, is more evidence, more paperwork of what's going on, rather than a he said, she said. But yeah, communicating with the landlord, even if, you know, people get behind in the rent, they start avoiding the landlord. It's understandable. Nobody wants to pay the rent. Nobody wants to deal with a landlord when they're behind in their rent. But, you know, that communication, if the landlord doesn't hear anything from you, their only option is, you know, to do eviction, or just if they're not hearing anything from you. But, you know, if you can work out some sort of payment plan, they might be reasonable on it. You know, obviously not always the case, but in some cases, they are actually required, if it's the first time, is that even if they filed the eviction against you, if you have the money on hand, if you're able to pay your rent, which, you know, these aid organizations might be able to help you, they're required to accept it. and dismiss the eviction if you can pay the back rent. This is in the city of Chicago. So, you know, I recommend that. If at all possible.
Yeah, for people, I mean, every situation is different, right? And it depends on if your landlord is, you know, the lady that lives upstairs versus a big old corporation. Like, that has to all play part of this. I know the laws are similar, but I guess I'm talking about the individual circumstances. Some people probably haven't maybe paid rent since COVID started, and that's got to be a lot different than maybe that someone has just missed a few months, right? Like, is that why talking with these groups and these lawyers are going to help you out navigate what can be a complicated situation and a very individual situation?
Yes, and even if you owe, you know, months of back rent, some of the federal programs are designed to pay off that back rent.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not just going forward. It's something that might, I mean, it is an individual situation within the city limits of Chicago. If the landlord lives in the building, in general, your rights can be very different if it's a very small mom and pop situation where you live above your landlord or not. But with eviction, you have a lot of rights, and those apply to any renter in the city. Just very briefly, the eviction process, basically, the landlord has to serve paper on you. The landlord goes to court. The tenant doesn't have to go to court to get evicted. If the landlord is the only one in court, they can still get an eviction, what's called an order of possession. And then once the landlord has that paperwork, the order of possession, they have to go to the Cook County Sheriff, and then the sheriff actually carries out the order of possession. So the sheriff will come knock on your door and say, it's time to get out. You've got to get out. So, you know, you don't want that to be the first time you start thinking about how you're going to respond to the situation, is once they're already putting you out on the street.
What is the timeline like from start to finish?
It really depends. I mean, I think it's often in the wintertime, you know, in under normal circumstances, from the order of possession being placed with the sheriff to them carrying it out, it can be a month or more. Obviously, right now, you know, who knows how they're going to handle it, because, you know, there's potentially, I was reading, 400,000 people that could be subject to eviction just in Illinois. So, you know, I imagine there's going to be an enormous backlog, which gives the landlords incentive to work something out. Because
So they
really should, you know, they, if at all possible, just from a business perspective, they should, if they can get partial rent or something like that, they should work. But a lot of it is going to fall on the tenant to protect themselves, because that's just the way things are. So they really, you know, it's, nobody has time for it. It's a pain. It can be like a second job. But, you know, getting ahead of the problem and finding those resources through the different organizations, there's not just one organization that can solve all the problems. Like I said, the LCBH is a great resource. IllinoisRentalAssistance.org, Rentervention.com. It's kind of a network, and you kind of have to do your homework and find what you can. The Metropolitan Tenants Organization in the city does a great amount of work, too, especially if it's a landlord doing kind of bulk evictions in a larger building. They do a great job organizing tenants.
Can someone reach out? Because, like, even that is like, oh, my God, I feel overwhelmed with how many people are trying to help. Like, that's a great thing. But it's like, where do you even start? Can people reach out to you guys and you can help them out?
My office is very small.
Okay.
Us personally, so it's just two lawyers. And like I said, we don't normally do eviction defense, so I'm not the first step.
Okay.
And we, on the other hand, if it's a kind of a specialized situation, one thing that often happens in these is foreclosures. If a renter is living in a building and they think the landlord's being foreclosed on, that's something that my office can work with, that, because that's more of a smaller type situation. But that very frequently, somebody that is still employed, hasn't been affected by COVID, but they don't know what's going on because they start getting notices from banks and all these other things, and they don't want to be paying rent to somebody that no longer owns the building. And it can be very confusing. But until that foreclosure is completed, the landlord still owns the building and can still evict you. But it's just a very confusing for tenants, and so you might need some help navigating that situation. And if the landlord has actually lost the building in foreclosure, there's city ordinance to protect you in that situation.
Yeah.
It's basically, it's a whole web of different rights and things that it's hard for the tenant, because none of the organizations are big enough to help everyone.
Right.
So you have to find the person, and there's a lot of local organizations that do great work in different neighborhoods.
I guess the overall message is there's a lot of people that want to help. You just got to do a little work to do it, and don't avoid the situation. Talk to the people you need to talk to, whether it's a landlord, the lawyer, or whatever. Talk to people. You're going to be better off in the long run.
For sure. And then one message I really want to get out there is the only people that can legally put you out are the Cook County Sheriff. A lot of landlords I know are going to get frustrated with the eviction process and try to do a self-help eviction. You know, change the locks, shut off the utilities, just, you know, threats. That is completely illegal. You can sue the landlord for that, but it's self-help eviction like that. Landlord can't go that route.
Cook County Sheriff's the only one that can come in.
Right. And so if the landlord does that, if the landlord is shut, you know, in the winter, they shut off the heat to move it, force a tenant out. All of that's completely illegal. A lot of tenants call the police in those situations. The police are supposed to help you there, but a lot of them get confused by the situation.
Right.
Like, that's been my experience. And the police just say, look, this is an eviction matter. You need to go to court. I don't know. So it's not a strong recommendation for me to call the police to sort that out, because realistically, I haven't had great experience with them knowing what to do in that situation, but they should let you back in and protect you.
All right. Hey, Nicholas, I'm sorry. I got to let you go. We are. Yeah, I really appreciate you. No, you're great. No, you know a lot about this and it's important information. We'll have to have you on again. Attorney Nicholas Bailey. We appreciate the time. Okay.
No problem. So yeah, just get involved and save your paperwork.
Amen. That's my message. Amen to that. Thank you, Nicholas. He knows what he's talking about. We got to take a quick break. I know, Ryan, I know, Steve, you have guesses for our trivia question. In 2006, 76,000 people did this. 10 years later, only 44,000 Americans are doing this every single year. We'll find out what that is after the break on WGN. All right, wrapping up, let's get legal here on WGN. In 2006, 76,000 people in America did this. 10 years later, that number had dropped to 44,000 Americans doing this in a single year. Let's go to Ryan. Ryan, thanks for holding. What's your guess on the trivia?
I'm thinking it's people getting married.
No, that's a great guess, because I know the marriage rates are going down a little bit, but that's not the answer. Sorry, thanks for holding. Let's go to Steve. Steve, what's your guess?
I would say vote.
Voting. Now, if only 44,000 people voted, that would be a problem. But yes, actually, in the last election, voting was through the roof, my friend. But that's a great guess, Steve. Thanks for calling in.
All right, thanks, Dave.
Guess what? No one got the answer. And I'm not going to tell you. That's a tease for the next Let's Get Legal, which, get your pencils and scorecards ready, will be next Sunday. Yes, we are on Sunday. We've got Northwestern and Blackhawks next Saturday. So we are on Sunday at 5 o'clock, and we'll continue with that question and plenty more. This has been John Hanson for Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. I'm in for Bertrand on Monday on Chicago's Afternoon News. See you then. News next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.